This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The debate over Confederate monuments has simmered for generations, but in recent months it has gone from stewing to boiling over. Confederate statues have been removed in more than a dozen states, including Texas, Louisiana, Maryland, Florida, and New York. Some were removed quietly in the night by officials fearing public safety. One statue outside the courthouse in Durham was toppled by protesters who took matters into their own hands. As these monuments become rallying points for white supremacist hate groups and their opposition, they open deep wounds in this country and big questions about how we remember our past. Leonita Inge is WNC's race and Southern culture reporter, and she's been following events in the Piedmont. Welcome, Leonita.
Thanks, Frank.
You were there in the aftermath of the toppling of the Confederate monument in Durham. How are people feeling about taking direct action for these monuments? They've been here for a long time, obviously, and this was the moment that they actually pulled it down. What were they saying about that?
Well, first of all, I've covered so many of these rallies over the years, and when I think of the one in Durham and a lot of cities, you notice they're like a near college town. Right. So you have a lot of college students. Maybe they're just learning their history all of a sudden. They feel they have to, you know, they have this big voice. But one thing about the toppling of the statue outside the old courthouse in Durham, you know, after that happened, I talked to people in their 40s, 50s, 60s. I mean, just lawyers, teachers, artists who were coming out there pretty much in a kind of happy shock, they were saying, like they just could not believe it, and they had to come out. They didn't feel threatened or unsafe or whatever we saw in the video, especially when the statue first toppled down. It actually looked pretty dangerous, didn't it? It came down hard. But no, they said they just had to see it for themselves.
Well, and the implication here that people have been living for quite a while and living with these monuments for quite a while, and suddenly it comes down. You talked with someone named Rochelle Sparco, who was looking at the downed monument in Durham as you spoke with her.
This is a thing that exists in our town that's bothered me since I moved here. And, you know, but it was always kind of, oh, well, that sucks that that's there. And you never really felt like there was a lot that at least I could do about it. And so knowing that the statue had come down, I thought, it doesn't fix it, but it's somehow cathartic.
It was Durham resident Rochelle Sparco who spoke with WNC's Leonita Inge. I'm speaking with her today. That was just after the monument in Durham came down. Durham, in some ways, is unique. I mean, it is one of the cities where direct action has taken down a monument. And Durham has a long history of protest activity. And in this case, an interesting sidelight in that a number of people have come forward volunteering to be arrested for the event, right?
You know, when Takiyah Thompson, the North Carolina Central University student, was arrested and three others quickly followed, it really upset a lot of folks. So one day, I just saw outside the new Durham courthouse, just like 100 people all standing out there, many of them wearing black T-shirts, and about 30 of them lined up sort of symbolically saying they were going to turn themselves in, claiming that they should be arrested too. You know, this was, they really felt this was a community effort, and they believed in what had happened, and they wanted to do their part. And of course, they were upset that these people were charged with felonies for bringing down that statue. And they were not arrested, mainly because there were no warrants out for their arrest, but they were there to show, like, true solidarity.
Well, you talked with Serena Sebring as one of those individuals who was part of that rally. Let's listen.
I was not there that day, but I feel strongly that it needed to come down, that I support it coming down, and I would have pulled that rope if I was there.
Serena Sebring, who went to the Durham courthouse to be arrested for the toppling of the monument, WNC's Leonita Inge is here. What's the sense in Durham? Because, again, there was a rumored rally earlier this week, a KKK rally, and on rumors of that, within a couple of hours, a counter-demonstration was mounted and thousands of people poured into the streets to counter a demonstration that never really happened.
It was a counter-demonstration, and it almost turned into, like, a crazy love fest. I mean, there were people out there with burning sage, you know, going around making sure people were safe to make sure, you know, that nothing bad happened. There were a few documented people, maybe one or two, who were there that people felt were white supremacists, but they were quickly shut down, and they actually left. But it shows that it's almost like Durham, they know their place in history, and they're almost waiting for a fight, no matter what the situation is when it comes with these Confederate statues. Because some of the same people that I've seen at these rallies, I've seen them at demonstrations about minimum wage. I've seen them at demonstrations about fair and affordable housing. And so that's the community we live in.
And one of the things it indicates is that there's a deeper understanding now, and I think the Bernie Sanders campaign may well have illustrated this as well, a deeper understanding of the root causes of some of this stuff. So it's not just about a monument, not just about what it says in our community, though that may be important, but a deep understanding of the multiple tentacles that are at the root of all of this stuff. That may be interesting going forward. Let's talk about, we've been talking about Durham, let's talk about the University of North Carolina. Silent Sam, lots of debates and demonstrations over the years. That monument is still standing. What's the future there? What's the story in Chapel Hill?
Maybe it's still standing because it's so heavy. It's going to be hard to remove Silent Sam, but it can be done, I hear. Right now there's a fence around Silent Sam. I think two fences around Silent Sam, because there's a lot of talk about a demonstration today, actually. And the university has taken a stand. You know, they want the community to be safe, and they want people to know this is not a sanctioned Carolina event. But it's going to go down possibly like that. I mean, the governor has even agreed with the university and even the mayor of Chapel Hill that you can remove this statue, especially if there's safety concerns. And maybe he got that from Duke University, who moved their statue of Robert E. Lee at like 3 a.m. Saturday.
Took it out because of safety concerns in general, and of course at night because that would be the safest time. Well, I want to bring Jordan Green into this conversation now. Jordan is the senior editor at Triad City Beat in Greensboro. He's been tracking movements and messaging of white supremacist groups in North Carolina. He also witnessed the protest that turned fatal in Charlottesville. Welcome back, Jordan.
Hey, Frank. Good to be here with you and your audience.
You have said the far right is focusing on Confederate monuments now. That is now the kind of focal point of their conversations. Why this fight now?
Well, the Confederate monuments gives the white supremacist movement an opportunity to broaden their base. Their objective, the creation of a white ethno-state, is not very palatable to very many folks, but with the Confederate monuments, they can kind of appeal to a sense of Confederate heritage and Southern pride. And even, you know, like President Trump talks about the monuments being beautiful. So it's really kind of an opportunity, I guess.
You've been tracking, as we said, white supremacist groups. You're paying attention to their message boards, et cetera. What shifts are you seeing in the way that they're engaging with each other and with opposition groups?
Well, so the group, that the coalition that held the August 12th Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, led by Richard Spencer, is kind of a fresh scrubbed, young, tech-savvy, more highly educated, although part of that coalition, the traditionalist Workers' Party, is more working class. But they kind of consider themselves the new face of white supremacy. And August 12th was, they described it as their kind of opportunity to move from an internet movement to a movement that takes public space and claims fleshy power. So they really feel like this is their moment, and they want to continue the momentum. There are other kind of older line white supremacist groups, notably the Ku Klux Klan, a local Ku Klux Klan, local to us here in North Carolina, the Loyal White Knights. They also held a rally in Charlottesville in July, which had a much smaller attendance. But they are very extreme, and in the aftermath of Charlottesville, August 12th, are looking probably to jockey for position within the movement. So that, I would say, is very concerning.
Of course, the use of violence now is the wild card in all of this. As the demonstrations escalate, how and whether violence will be an important part of this. You've shadowed an armed group called Redneck Revolt. Tell us about them.
They're a group that kind of anarchist communists that kind of came together around the time of around July 2016, and then they really took off after the inauguration of President Trump. They're unique in a couple ways. One is that they're adamantly pro Second Amendment. I think it's fair to call them a militia. They train with firearms and engage in community defense. They also organize in kind of predominantly white rural spaces to try to provide an alternative for white working class people who are alienated and potentially attracted to white supremacy.
It's an interesting turn, Jordan. I'm running out of time little bit, but I want to know just briefly how they're being perceived by other sort of left-oriented groups.
Well, surprisingly well, actually. I mean, their role in Charlottesville is they provided an armed security detail for a park where leftists had a permit. They had about 20 members there, 12 of them armed with assault rifles, and a lot of leftists were grateful to them for providing a safe place.
Jordan Green is senior editor at the Triad City Beat, also talking with Leonida Inge, WNC's race and culture reporter. Here in the South, you're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. There's more just ahead. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. In today's heated debate about Confederate monuments, we may lose track of the truth about when and why they were erected in the first place. That history can help inform our modern conversations and expand the dialogue about what should be done moving forward. Joining me now are three professors who have examined the Southern history of memorialization. Fitzhugh Brundage is the chair of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He also advises a digital archive effort called the Commemorative Landscapes of North Carolina. Fitz, welcome back to The State of Things.
Glad to be here.
Also joining us is Darren Waters. He's a professor of history at UNC Asheville. Darren, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Frank.
And we're speaking with Monica Gisalfi, who's a professor of history of the American South at UNC Wilmington. Monica Gisalfi, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Fitz, let me start with you because you have written about this, I think 13 years ago you published a book on this very subject, and yet you say now the landscape has changed dramatically since that book came out.
It certainly has. I think really since Dylann Roof's massacre in Charleston 2 years ago, the cultural landscape has changed in a way that has accelerated not only the removal of the Confederate battle flag from public spaces, but in a way set in motion the taking down of four very prominent monuments in New Orleans, and now has contributed, I think, to our conversation after Charlottesville. So I think we're having a conversation that we never previously had about what to do with these monuments.
It's interesting. Darren, let me ask you, Darren Waters, in many ways the conversation itself, the issues that are central to this conversation haven't much changed, but there does seem to be more movement these days, would you say?
I think so. It's interesting as I look at this. We're in the sesquicentennial of Reconstruction, of the period of Reconstruction, and it seems to me that we are embarking on a new Reconstruction here, a Reconstruction of the narrative of American history.
You have been involved in the conversation there at UNC Asheville and the surrounding area about Zebulon Vance Monument in Asheville. Tell us about the conversations you're having now.
Well, you know, the conversations really have been around what to do with the Vance Monument here. But what I have been arguing, especially as a professional historian who I'm happy to say who was trained in part by Dr. Brundage. So in one way, I'm honored to be here with him. In another way, somewhat nervous about that because I want to make sure that I do him well. But as we look at the Vance Monument here in Asheville. Vance as a figure is a complicated figure. I don't think that it is a cut and dry issue. Vance is someone who, while he served as governor of the state during the Civil War, was just as much a thorn in the side of Jefferson Davis as he was to the Union Army itself. And that's something that I find as I have conversations with people that people don't really realize. You know, if we take, for example, the conscription law that required able-bodied men to fight in the Confederate Army, to serve in the Confederate Army, Vance stood in the way of that for North Carolinians. And again, as I've told people, he was a political leader in the state before the war began. He just happened to serve as governor while the state was in the Confederacy and going through the Civil War. So I think that we need to have a broader understanding of the history of Vance, not just looking at this one specific issue.
Monica Gisalfi, you think that Wilmington is a microcosm for this entire issue writ large nationally and certainly here in North Carolina. Tell us about Wilmington's Confederate monuments and why that that city and those monuments are so important to this conversation.
Well, Wilmington helps us understand what many historians see as the three waves of Confederate monument building. The first that took place between the 1890s and 1910s, just as the Jim Crow system was being fastened upon the South. And so Wilmington has a monument from 1910 to George Davis, the Attorney General of the Confederacy. Then this sort of second wave of Confederate monument building that takes place in the 1920s and 30s takes place as at the height of Black disenfranchisement, segregation, and lynching. And then the last phase is in the 1950s and 1960s when white Southerners begin building monuments to the Confederacy again and naming streets as well to Confederate generals in reaction to the Brown v. Board of Ed decision and as part of the movement of massive resistance. And so Wilmington, as I said, is this microcosm because we have the 1911 George Davis statue, a 1924 Confederate monument to the common soldier. And then in 1957, a subdivision was developed in Wilmington, and the street names in that subdivision were named for Nathan Bedford Forrest, one of the founders of the Klan, and for Robert E. Lee. And so these sort of three, these monuments and then the naming of streets in Pine Valley help us to understand the evolution of Confederate monument building. And to kind of speak to what Fitz had said about being in this new phase of sort of reckoning with the meaning of the Confederacy in the wake of Dylann Roof's massacre, what's actually been, I would argue that perhaps there's a fourth phase unfolding in Wilmington because the United Daughters of the Confederacy dedicated a new interpretive marker at a 1932 Confederate monument that's down in Fort Fisher. And on that, they adamantly argue that the Confederacy fought to protect states' rights, not slavery. And you can kind of see this as a backlash against South Carolina removing its flag, against this national reckoning with the meaning of the Civil War.
Well, Fitz, let's pursue that thought a little bit. And I invite you, all three of you, to comment on this, but I'll start with Fitz. And that is that based on, you know, what Monica is saying, that in many ways, these monuments, whatever else they represented and whether they represented the valor of fighting people in a war, that may have been true. But they came at a time when they were a reaction to, generally speaking, growing power among African-American populations or a reaction to the potential so that these monuments have to be seen as a reaction to that as well, don't they?
Certainly. I think we should understand the monuments, as you said, in a relational context. They were not just put up in order to honor Confederate soldiers. They did do that, of course, but they were also put up to be a counter response to the monuments that Northerners were putting up to the Union cause. And, of course, they were also monuments that in their own way confirmed or were intended to establish the power and cultural privilege of white elites in the South at whatever moment in time they were put up.
So, Darren Waters, let's talk about this, the complexity. You mentioned Zeb Vance as a complex figure. It really raises the question about how we, what we're doing with a monument or a statue. That's a pretty, there's not a lot of contextualization when you put up a statue of an individual, and they are complex individuals who came at a you know, always complicated times, dynamic times in their own history. What about the whole question of whether we should be putting up simple statues to individuals because they can never possibly represent all that they meant to a community?
Exactly. And I think that that's something that individual communities, a conversation that individual communities need to be allowed to have as they think about this. I mean, because you take the Vance Monument in Asheville, here in Asheville, for example, you wouldn't be able to tell this Confederate monument. But for the fact you'd have to know the history of Vance is an obelisk. So he and without the plaque that exists on that, you would not know that it is a Confederate monument. And then when you look at the time period when the Vance Monument was erected, it was erected in part as a gift by George Pack, who was a Northerner who relocated to Asheville. And it was, I think, erected 4 years after Vance passed away. So I'm not so sure that it fits real comfortably in this this period of a Confederate monument building to kind of reflect the Confederacy in a very different way, and that's what makes it so complex. I am bothered by the fact that the state has chosen to pass a law that makes it difficult for individual communities to make a determination on their own about what to do about these monuments. I mean, it is a concentration of power in Raleigh in a way that that I don't think is good for the individual communities, because if anything, this period, I think, offers us the opportunity to engage history in a very different way and to engage in building human relations between different segments of our community in a very different way. And I think that that could happen with good leadership. This time period, I think, offers us many possibilities.
Monica, stay with that thought for a little bit, because in Wilmington, again, the question of who gets to write history is never so clearly understood as how we had understood for about 100 years something called the Wilmington Race Riot, which we now know to be the Wilmington coup d'etat, after 100 years of improperly telling that story. And so the question of who gets to tell the story and who gets to decide, you know, which monuments reflect what history, it seems to me vital, and there's no better place to make the point than Wilmington.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. The monuments are an expression of power and a marker of who has the power to choose how history is remembered in public places. And your question is important because it points to the fact that within the last 10 years, Wilmington erected a monument to the Wilmington Massacre and coup. That, as you said, for a good 100 years had sort of been buried and denied and cast as a disorganized sort of event where African Americans were causing an array of problems, when in fact the coup and massacre were something very different. In November of 1898, white Democrats carried out an organized attack on African Americans in Wilmington, and this was a response to, this had been part of an election-wide, national, statewide campaign against that was seeking to destroy interracial democracy in the state. The organized bloodshed in Wilmington was the culmination of this Democratic statewide electoral campaign. And in Wilmington, there was bloodshed, local elite organized essentially an attack on African Americans that led to the killing of between 14 and 60 African Americans. And then on November 10th, they staged the only documented coup to take place in American history. Leaders of the massacre, including Alfred Wydell, who would appoint himself mayor, unseated the mayor, the chief of police, and members of the board of aldermen. And now we do have a monument in Wilmington, a memorial to the Wilmington coup. So it is important, I think, as I'm talking about Wilmington as a microcosm, it is important to think about the importance of that monument.
Well, and the importance of public memory in general fits, but and the question is, and particularly for those who would defend Confederate monuments, they say, look, this is an important part of our history, like it or not. This is who we are, and we need to reflect this in a public space to not forget all of that. How do you respond to that, given the fact that these are in public places?
Well, I certainly agree that we don't want to, as a historian, I have a, shall we say, a personal interest in people not forgetting the past. But seriously, we obviously don't want to somehow erase the history of the Confederacy and slavery and the Wilmington coup, etc. And but the question at hand, I think, is whether or not monuments somehow are the best way in which to somehow teach and or preserve history. If these monuments did such a great job of teaching history, we obviously would have students who did really well in history classes because there are lots of these monuments. And I'm being somewhat glib there, but my larger point is that monuments aren't the best way to teach history. They are certainly monuments to a particular set of attitudes that are crystallized at a particular moment in time. And let me just make the suggestion that I think in part, as Monica said, this is about power, but it's also about power in place and space, if you will. And so to suggest that these monuments might be preserved, but that they be preserved somewhere other than the very conspicuous, prominent public spaces they currently occupy is not to erase them. It's rather to return that public space to uses that we might put to it today that are more democratic, more inclusive, and perhaps more productive of the type of society we want to live in today, as opposed to the society that the people who put the monuments up created 100 years ago.
Darren Waters, are your conversations evolved enough in Asheville and up in Western North Carolina to know whether people are making these kinds of suggestions? What are the solutions that you're hearing in your part of the country?
I want to say that I agree with what Fitz had to say about this, and that's where the conversation seems to be going. I mean, after the governor's statement that the monuments should be moved, there has been kind of the idea of removing Confederate monuments that are in the heart of the city here has picked up steam. But again, with some reservations about about the Vance Monument itself, there are, I think, four or five Confederate markers right in the heart of downtown Asheville besides the Vance Monument. And some have argued that those should be removed. And there has been an effort by a group here to remove one of those. And you probably saw the reports about that. But I think that what we're trying to do here is to at least begin the process of having a larger conversation. In next month, beginning on September 14th and 15th, we will be hosting a symposium at the University of North Carolina at Asheville entitled Vance Reconsidered, where I think a number of these questions will come up. And what we're hoping that it will do is get the community to engage in a serious conversation about, you know, what these spaces look like. The city and the county not too long ago created an African American Heritage Commission, which has been considering the possibility of a monument to African Americans, to the African American experience here in Asheville and Western North Carolina, somewhere in the same space. Those conversations are being had, and it will be interesting to see how they work themselves out and they're resolved. But again, I would argue that good leadership here is necessary on how those conversations proceed.
Monica, you talked about a plaque recently put on, you know, added to one of the monuments in Wilmington by the Daughters of the Confederacy. I don't know how much conversation there was about that, but it suggests that perhaps at least in that moment there wasn't much other input. I wonder if the conversations are becoming more robust and more rounded these days.
I think that the case, and it's a monument that's down at Fort Fisher, so about 20 miles south of Wilmington. I think in that case, it sort of points to the problem of many people say, oh, well, we should keep these monuments and then put up an interpretive marker. If you have a group coming in and writing an interpretive marker that's entirely inaccurate, then you're only continuing the problem that exists. So I think that's something to sort of think about. I also wonder about this proposal, and there has been some proposals in Wilmington saying, well, let's put up a statue to Frederick Douglass alongside the statue of George Davis or something along these lines. People make these proposals. And I think what you do, if you were to put a statue up to Frederick Douglass in Wilmington, what you would be doing is you'd be further elevating George Davis, the Attorney General of the Confederacy. You would be further elevating the monument to the Confederate soldier, and you would be setting up a false equivalence where you would be saying both of these people, all of these people are freedom fighters, and we want to honor all of them. And so I think that I'm opposed to this notion that all we need are more statues for fair and balanced telling of the story. The monuments, the Confederate monuments, represent injustice and inequality. And I think that I agree with Governor Cooper and believe that they need to come down, and that putting up another monument again to, let's say, Frederick Douglass is not going to solve the problem that we're facing in North Carolina.
Fitz, we are having these conversations. Monuments are coming down. There is some kind of change afoot. Do you think that it fundamentally changes the conversation on race that is also required in this country?
I am not. Well, let me start over and say that that would be asking an awful lot of this topic, this question, if you will, this issue to carry the weight of. We Americans have curious ways of debating the problems of race in our society. Sometimes we delve into them deeply in ways that who would have ever thought, for example, O.J. Simpson's trial would have become the foundation for a dialogue, conversation, and argument briefly. But we delve into them, and then the events of the present day overwhelm them, and we drop them. But having said that, I do think this is a debate that is meaningful and in some communities can have a real far-reaching impact. In other communities, who knows?
Fitzhugh Brundage is Department Chair of History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Darren Waters, Professor of History at UNC Asheville. And Monica Gisolfi is a Professor of History and the American South at UNC Wilmington. I want to thank all of you for being on our program today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just ahead, we preview the gospel musical Crowns that starts with the premise, every hat tells a story. Stay with us on The State of Things.